So I've been reflecting on the number of things that could be useful to talk about tonight, but I really have no idea what I'm going to say. So that's a nice blank page, which could be almost a symbol for what we all wish in our life. Start the day with a blank page, have a blank space for the next year or so. Space to do whatever happens, and not to have a well-filled agenda and lots of appointments and lots of things to do. So maybe this is one of the advantages of renunciate life, is that you don't have a lot of money, but you have a lot of space. In fact, you don't have any money at all. But, but lots of inner space. Oh, at least you are encouraged to discover this inner space that comes from just the practice of Dhamma, the practice of focusing one's attention on things that really, in a way, as somebody who is on the path, things that really matters. In the worldly life, like many of you, I'm sure, I don't think many monks and nuns here, in the life of our everyday life, you have a lot of demands, you have a lot of activities, and a lot of energy is spent just going out. A lot of energy spent just trying to sort the world out there. In the monastic life, you spend a lot of time just sorting the world in there, in the mind itself. So it's not that different, really. People think that when you come to the monastery, you know, your mind is going to be very peaceful, you're going to have suddenly a very quiet, gentle, unencumbered, simple lifestyle. Well, I just want to dissolve any illusion about this. The busyness that we've left behind continues in the monastery in some ways, even though the structure of monastic training is a reminder of keeping things simple, yet the mind isn't simple, as we know. So we may think that our world, our troubled world, our troubled life is caused by all the entanglements that we are sort of encountering on a daily basis, whether it's in our family, in our relationship, in our work, with ourselves, with our health, with our, you know, with so many things. We tend to, you know, our attention is so focused externally by the very style of life that we have, that we forget where it all begins. We forget the source of our troubles. So we can come to a place like this to be reminded where it all begins and it all ends, if we've seen the ending tonight. Because unless we see the source of our difficulties, of our pain, of our suffering, and it's you know, and see clearly that there is a quality of impermanence, fluidity, change in our experience, it's very much like living in a prison, isn't it? It's like you feel so tight, so stuck in this life, and so unfree, you know, with so little space, so little kind of ability to see clearly. I don't think any of us will be here if we hadn't really discovered that the world or our life has a limit in how much it can give us in terms of happiness, in terms of fulfillment, in terms of joy, and so on. Most of us, I would say here, have been able to come to this uncomfortable realization that the world as it is not our fulfillment at a I wouldn't want to use the word ultimate level necessarily, but at a certain level it's not a fulfilling experience, because the fulfillment of a human being doesn't lie into perfecting the worldly life. It doesn't lie there. That's why we keep being frustrated, because at some level this is where we are looking. We're looking in the wrong place. It's not that if we had choice we would do something, we would certainly do something different, but very often we haven't got that much choice, at least on the appearance level. You know, the seeming level, there's a level where it is very difficult to see that maybe we have choices, we have options. So the meditation practice that we've done tonight is really the first step to recognize, for one thing, that we have a mind. You know, we walk around very often as if we were just a sort of mass of things that can't see very far, with a sense that there is a problem, but you can't get your finger on it. Put your finger on it. You can't, there's a sense that something's not quite right. But you don't quite get, the why and the how and, And there are nowadays, fortunately, we're living in a time in our, in a period of our human life where there are vast numbers of things, of teachings and teachers and, paths and traditions and means, resources, tools and so on that are can be very helpful to understand ourselves a little bit more clearly, a bit more deeply, to understand the limits of our habits, the insatisfactoriness of our, of greed and of anger and just plain stupidity. We can spend quite many years being quite happily stupid, with a joyfully stupid. I'm sure none of you have sort of seen this. It's called the comfort zone, And there are, it's not that easy to detect delusion, because it's so linked together with comfort, emotional comfort. So, this path of awakening, as it's sometimes called, it's not, if we knew the Dhamma truly, it's not that difficult to walk this path, but it's also a path that's riddled with paradoxes, and that's why we can get very confused even about the path of practice, even about Buddhism, because if our mind is still hooked on the desire to become, to get rid of things, to avoid, to fulfill ourselves with any of the desire that course our mind, any of the desire that sort of fill our citta, our mind, then we are going to bump into this very kind of frustrated experience. Our fulfillment is not there. And the paradox is that we often, at first in our practice we want to become, we want to stop the becoming of suffering, and we want to become happy, which is the second noble truth in the heart of the Buddhist teaching of the Four Noble Truths. The second noble truth is attachment to becoming attachment to non-becoming, and I don't want to become angry, I want to become good and kind and peaceful and loving. That is in itself is already that wanting, maybe a very good wanting, a very skillful kind of desire. But the paradox is that if you hang on to it in your meditation, you can constantly, you know, annoyed with yourself, angry, upset, and you wonder why Buddhism is not working for you. Why should it be working? If you keep on piling up the causes of suffering, it's no wonder it's not working, you know. Or the desire to become, the pleasant, experience of sensory desires, you know. Attaching to that, you know, attachment, tanha, it's called tanha, attaching to the desire to have a pleasant experience, that, you know, the birth of that very desire is painful. And as I said earlier, we can be joyfully, happily stupid without any question, you know, without any kind of qualms. Never know how to pronounce this word, but never mind. not to mention with an American accent. You know, so we wonder, we say, well, it's not working really. I think I go to the Advaita Vedanta, you know, at least they go straight to the ultimate, you know, and they say there is nothing. And I quite like the Advaita Vedanta teaching myself. I don't have any problem with it. But the path of the Buddhist practice is teaching you the skills of practice, the skills of dealing with the mind at a conventional level. So just recognizing that we want to become good and we don't want to become bad, I mean, to simplify it, in its extreme, you know. We want to become intelligent, we don't want to become stupid. We want to become the happiness of having all the good things in the world, and and every fear, of course, not having them. All this is caused, if we attach to it, it's caused the cause of suffering. So, where are we right now? It's interesting, isn't it? A lot of the practice is just witnessing the delusion of our mind, you know, how we get attached to things that even though we may have written a PhD on the Four Noble Truths, on Nibbana, on the ultimate liberation, yet if we don't know directly in the mind itself, you know, we have maybe a conceptual mind that is really quite articulate and refined and maybe very clear at an intellectual level. We have a clear understanding. But as I say often, if you keep on reading the cooking book and find out how you do a pizza, not that satisfactory really. Much nicer to eat a good warm pizza, isn't it? You know, nothing too satisfactory about reading the most ultimate cooking book about how to make a pizza, and even the ultimate pizza. You know, so we are often stuck at that, you know, because of our education, you know, we are part of a world where people can get highly trained mentally. You know, you go to the East, you know, you don't get that sort of same energy called opinionatedness. It doesn't mean we are worse or better, but we have, you know, the suffering of identification with the, you know, a very highly developed intellectual understanding of things. And sometimes, unfortunately, it can actually get us quite stuck if we just remain there without really looking for something more satisfying in terms of realization, inside understanding. Now, the first level of our path is in that level, the first level. You know, it is important to have a clear map of what the Buddhist teaching is about. So, getting to know the theory of Buddhist practice, getting to know the Buddhist teaching, whether it's in the suttas or commentaries and so on, whether listening to good teachers, you know, who can give maybe presentations on the teaching and so on. That's very useful. But what is the purpose of this path? Ask yourself. You know, it's not, you know, we're not doing something that is light. You know, at some level, everybody would like to present the path as if it was something just easygoing and so on. You know, our practice itself, you know, we need to remind ourselves there's nothing to do, nowhere to go, nothing to become, because this is just an antidote to the tendency to want to become, want to get down to some kind of, you know, task, so you don't forget your things to do of the day and you carry on in meditation easily. You know, but So from the point of your meditation practice, things are, you know, you are reminded that you need a very simple approach, direct approach. You know, just like the breath, you know, the body. This seems so simple for an intellect. It's not a big deal, is it? You can get very bored very quickly. So bored. Because after 5 minutes the knees start aching, the legs start, you know, restless, and the emotions start getting bored, and you start wondering what's next, when the time is finished, and then when you can't get what you want, then you start getting out of the room here and sort of go off somewhere, remembering an old movie, or, you know, hoping that it all ends quickly, or maybe wishing it will never end, whatever, but we start kind of proliferating on what's happening here and now. So this is called mental proliferation. Now, if you see this proliferation, that's really as craft of practice, that's a practice itself, just to see that the mind, what the mind is doing. You know, the Buddhist teaching in the Theravada tradition is very simple. The Buddha says, when you're bored, you just see you're bored. That's it. When there's a feeling of anger, you just know it, there is anger. When there is a feeling of greed, you know there is greed. I mean, that's very unsatisfactory on the intellectual level, have you noticed? We are left with nothing much, really. So we go back to the book, you know, the cookery book. Well, how do we do that, you know? And then we have different interpretation. We go to the greatest chef, you know. The more famous, the better. The more elaborate, you know. Of course, it had better to be in our own language. You wouldn't enjoy an Italian cookery book if you don't know Italian. So, you know, the paradox of practice is that we are looking at a mind that is concocting complexities, which become a world of complexities, a life of complexities, complex relationships, and so on. And we are addicted to that. It's a kind of addiction. You know, let's face it. I mean, we might not be taking drug, but there is a kind of, you know, a very definite addiction to a mind that does things. The mind of silence, a mind of peace, a mind of stillness is not really our cup of tea a lot of the time, is it? Except when we get really stressed out, on the verge of a breakdown, and maybe we think of being still and quiet. Or we've had a terrible row with our families, or you kind of try to lock yourself in your room and don't don't want to talk to anybody for a week. But most of the time, we are just, we forget, simply. We forget where the source of our problem begin, where our problems start. So in the meditation, just the simple act of sitting quietly is one of the, essential feature of the Buddhist path, developing the mind through stilling the mind, quietening the mind, not through forcefully doing that, just letting the mind settle, letting the mind just relax and recognize, the consciousness recognize that maybe there is nothing to do right now. Through habit, it keeps on going. But suddenly the penny dropped, maybe, and say, oh, there's nothing to do. I'm just with my boredom right now. Or with my anxiety, or whatever. Whatever is here at that moment. And you have noticed, of course, that even though there is nothing to do, it continues, piling up the to-do list. And I've got to do anapanasati, and I mustn't get distracted. And the teacher told me I have to get rid of restlessness. If you have not a very good teacher, I have to say, don't get rid of restlessness. Good teacher will tell you just be aware of restlessness. Don't move with it, in other words. Don't get the mind agitated about restlessness. And if it is agitated, be still with agitation. We complain. We can complain about the fact that our life is not working, time of recession, bank account going down, mortgage not being able to pay the mortgage, fear of being a bag lady. I've noticed there's not a bag guy. A bag guy. You notice that? People always talk to me about bag ladies, but it suddenly dawned on me, I never hear about bag guys. It's interesting, isn't it? See what awareness can do? Just begin to realize. It's not fair. So we have all reason to be worried, We can find right now all reason, We can have such a good case for being continuously worried and anxious. Confused and chaotic. Restless and, you can add the list yourself. To the list, you can add whatever you want. Stressed out, depressed, miserable, lonely. The list it can be long. So yes, of course, we have all the reason to feel those things, and there is no reason to need to get rid of any of these things. Through aversion and reactions, this is what we know. And to be honest, we have to recognize that all of us have been brought up just to react. Through aversion, through anger, through frustration, and so on. Most of our conditioning is in terms of, I am going to do something about it now. And it can work for certain things, you notice. There's time when it's a kind of skillful means. It actually, we can act and do something. But if it is done without this aversion, this anger, this sense of frustration, then it's a skillful, maybe, act. But if it is done out of aversion and frustration and anger, then you'll get the backlash of that, unfortunately. So you want to get rid of a problem, and you think moving away is going to do it. And maybe there is a wise moving away from difficult situation. The Buddha even it's one of the means to deal with difficult thoughts or difficult mind states. So just to distract oneself is one of the five ways of dealing with unskillful thoughts, unskillful states of mind. you know, just do something else. Go and walk the dog, you know, if you feel really depressed. That's one way of dealing with depression or misery. But as meditator, we want to go also to the root of the problem, and the root is in the mind itself, and to see perhaps what the Buddha, to witness for ourselves what the Buddha is telling us from the beginning of his teaching, that this is a path of liberation, this is a path leading to ultimate, profound, deep peace called Nibbana, the path of cooling down, the cooling down of all formations of greed, anger, and delusion, you know. So if we are really interested in this realization of the path, then we can't just go on being distracted. We want to really find a way of letting go and releasing our attachment to, let's say, depression, for example, or sadness or whatever. And this is when it becomes paradoxical for many people who have been conditioned to use the will and to really, you know, you got tons of books written about how to get rid of this and get rid of that and so on. Even though now the Dharma is filtering through a lot of the culture in America and in England and in Europe too, you know, there's more of a kind of wisdom around, you know, in the culture itself, a wisdom that is encouraging people not to be just simply reactive, upset, and just avoiding things, but to maybe turn towards the problem and look at it and find that means of resolving things through understanding, through patience, through the ability to bear with things which are difficult to bear with, and so on. So pointing to a particular aspect of ourselves which is not often touched into, like patience. When I was younger, before I became a nun, patience was like the mental state of a 90-year-old. My deluded mind, you know, sort of, had to be really old to be patient, and you had no other choice. That's what patience meant, you know. It's like, if you can't do anything, if you're paralyzed completely, then you'll be patient with your body. You know. So, how to go into this paradox, you know, to free the heart, to free our mind from any miserable mental state, any miserable thoughts, we have to be still with it. We have to see it and be still. Just do nothing. Because our conditioning will say, get out. Now, quick, as quickly as possible. Isn't it what we do a lot of the time with our life? If you think of your daily life, how many times this conditioning just arises in ourselves beyond our control? Beyond our control. And this is when the Buddha is pointing to a very useful realization of, you know, you've heard about the aspect of dukkha, you know, that all things are unsatisfactory and impermanent. And through our patient quality of awareness, mindfulness, then you will see more deeply that everything that happens to you, everything that you think, everything that you feel, is not under your control. You think it's under your control, but it's not, you know. And that, when you realize this, that thoughts arise and you wish it wouldn't, but you can't do anything about it. I mean, you can react, as I said, you can push them down, repress it, and so on, yes? But when you really look at your mind directly, you know, unbiased, with a clear mirror, a clear seeing, then you will see that all kinds of things arise and come and go without any invitation. They invite themselves. It's like guests who invite themselves and they leave when they want. You know, what else, what is the control there? Tell me. I mean, how many of you wish that your misery would have gone a long time ago? Intellectually, it seemed like it could, you know, you can probably, quite a few of you, I'm sure, can give a very good lecture on how to free oneself from suffering and be quite articulate and quite convincing. And yet, in oneself, we're still struggling with this old misery that happened 20 years ago and is still haunting us, and we wish it wouldn't, but there we are, you know. So, who is in charge? Ask yourself. Is it God? The Buddha? You know, there's nobody in charge, and that's what is called anatta, you know. There's no one there, kind of, you know. The only thing that really in charge, until we see through it a bit, is our delusion. Oh, our forgetfulness is constantly in charge of everything. You know, you want to get up a little bit early in the morning, do a bit of meditation, you know. Lord Avijja turns up and says, oh no, you can't do it. Oh no, not tomorrow, maybe next day, or, you know. You notice that, haven't you noticed, you know? Who is in charge? Forgetfulness, isn't it? That is mostly in charge of our life, unfortunately. So even in our, you know, even in our appreciation of what we do in our practice, we even forget that we are actually practicing and quite good people, you know? How many of you will spend a lot of time remembering all the things that you haven't done in your practice and all the failures of your practice, forgetting the good aspect of your human mind, forgetting maybe the good qualities that you have? Huh? But do we remember all the nasty things that we've done, don't we? We can spend a whole day, we can write books about it. People do. All the time. I mean, it's not too bad if they earn some money with it. Pay their debt. But we have this weird paradoxical tendency that we love peace, we may love the quality of freedom and liberation, some, even if we've tasted it just you know, for a few seconds, few moments. But it's really this strange paradox how much we forget again and again and again. That's why the Buddha said, be mindful, remember, sati, mindfulness, sampajanya, clear recollection, clear understanding, clear seeing. And sati means, it has also sometimes translated as memory. It reminds you, oh, I'm here now, there's no problem here now. How? But how many times do we create the reality of our future and even worse, the reality of the past? It's like, which is only a memory. Right now it's a memory, it's only a thought. But we make it, we give it so much importance. We make it so believable. Our grief for the past experiences, for our youth, for our departed relatives, for our friends who have left us, you know. We still forget that in the here and now, who is remembering this? Who is concocting the stories? Who is creating? It's interesting, isn't it? Once you start really, when you stop looking at the cookery book and start really getting down to making a good meal of your practice, it's quite fascinating, really. Just to see something so simple as who is creating this. Just to stop for a second and listen. and he did this and he did that, and she, oh my God, if I meet her again, you know, it's like, kill her. Now, I mean, ask yourself, who is talking here? It's interesting, yeah? I had my first insight after doing a 10-day retreat with Ajahn Sumedho in 1979. I had been watching my mind for 10 days, you know, and discovering sort of the joy of monastic schedule. I really liked getting up early. And discipline. I mean, I trained as a dancer, so I always liked discipline. I mean, I have a period where I hated it, I tell you. But, you know, at the time, discipline seems to be quite sort of familiar and quite comfortable for me, you know. And I remember after this 10-day retreat, I was in London, in the main street in London, coming out maybe out of a dance class or something. And I suddenly, you know, even though I had listened to, you know, meditated for 10 days, I had never been so aware at that very moment when my mind began to, you know, I began to see that I had an internal commentators commenting on everything and anything. And suddenly I thought, it was very strange. For the first time I actually heard it really loud. It was so bizarre, you know, it's like I'd been listening to my mind for 10 days, but suddenly this really loud commentators inside, I thought, who is talking here? I mean, I just thought it was so funny. Who is talking? I'm not interested in all that stuff. I mean, who is in charge here? Wait a minute, hey, can I ask who is doing the talking here? And it was very funny to me. It was suddenly, I saw it as a kind of quite humorous, you know, how I'd read lots of books on spiritualities and Buddhism, not so much on Buddhism, but Christianities and mystics and so on. You know, I read a lot of books on, you know, the world and the mind and so on. But suddenly, for the first time, I actually, you know, began to realize, you know, that I had a character there who I just met for the first time. I mean, he'd been around probably for a long, long time, but I just met this funny character that keep commentating on my life when I did not need to. So that was a realization, you know, of some sort. And I began to see, do I want to live with all those, you know, funny voices, all these commentators in my life? Who's in charge here? And then that's when you begin to see the usefulness of remembering. Because our mind, you know, for many, many years of practice, things don't just kind of go poof and there's nothing there. That would be nice. A great part of our practice is actually to develop enough patience to listen to the conditionings of our own chitta, mind. To really listen, to have the ability to be still with the mind. So you get to know all its tricks. And it has many. It will make you feel tired when you are not. It will make you feel bored when things could be really interesting. It will create heaven when you're in hell. Ask an alcoholic. He wouldn't drink if he didn't think it was going to give him some happiness. You know, delusion is the great trickster. And, you know, we need to know where things begin. Otherwise, we think we have to solve the whole world. I mean, we are exposed day in, day out to the, you know, to media, which keep telling us that the world is wrong. I think we don't need the media to know that. We can just meditate on our mind, and you can see the world that arises in the mind is perfectly unsatisfactory, as you've noticed, you know. You don't need to know there is war in Iraq. Afghanistan is getting worse. you know, that things are, you know, there's cheating everywhere in society, that the finance are down and so on, you know. You don't need to know that much, you know, to know that the world is very unsatisfactory. And yet, have you noticed how many times we draw our attention outwardly again and again? Not only that, but the world we are part of is completely, you know, intent on make you believe that the problem is out there. Completely intent. It's like, you know, forcibly intent on this. And make you forget where it begins. It's so amazing, you know, how many times this goes on, like all the time. You look at billboards, it keeps reminding you, billboards, for example, you know, without not necessarily talking about TV and other things, you know, billboards, you know, are one of the highest training in developing the five hindrances, for example, of greed, hatred, doubt, fear, restlessness, and worry. You have a perfect training there. Just keep looking at the billboard, and you become an expert on restlessness, doubts, worry, fear, agitations, wanting more, disliking your last fridge that you bought 6 months ago, last refrigerator, and wanting a new one. Makes you hate your old car that you bought 2 years ago and make you become really desirous of this beautiful new brand of cars. And even in the spiritual path, you know, avidya is at play and it has quite a lot of power, you know, to make you believe that one teaching is not good enough, go and dig another hole somewhere and into the Sufi tradition. And then, you know, in America, you might not be aware so much, maybe not in Seattle, but at least in San Francisco. You know, if you don't have four, five, or six teachers, there's something missing in your life. You know, I felt slightly embarrassed when I went back to England and I was telling this to people, you know. Or when I came here, I said, I only have one tradition, one teacher, you know. It's like, what's wrong with her? Mind you, since then I did a retreat with absorption teacher and so on. I got the bug. I mean, not me, but people encouraged me to kind of get into it. So, you know, we are, you know, this kind of forgetfulness keeps us in a state of, you know, our dissatisfaction. You know, we feel there's something missing. Again, we forget where the source is, we forget where we are, don't we? We forget. We forget where the tools are, where the wisdom is, where the compassion is, you know. And there we are, back again on the treadmill of birth, death, restlessness, worry, anxiety, fear, and so on. So unless you have the ability of really stopping, you know, you see those Buddhas with the two hands like this, stopping the world. And what is the world in Buddhism? Fortunately, we don't have to sort out the whole world. That would be really a problem. We probably were polluting the earth as well if we had to sort out the whole world and have to travel everywhere. But the Buddha said the world, you know, someone, one of his disciples once came and said to him, the end of the world, what is a world? And, you know, how do you put an end to the world? What is a world and coming to the end of the world? And the Buddha said, well, it's not by walking to the end of the world, you only come to the end of the world. But there is no ending of the world without the ending of suffering. So, the Buddhist teaching points to the fact that the world in Buddhism is the suffering we create. Not your family, not your job, not your life, The world is the suffering we create. And this world, the Buddha says, is in this fathom-long body. And that is where the world arises and the world ends. Yes? So, are we prepared to really see this suffering we create for ourselves, which the Buddha calls the world, this creation, this attachment to our mind, to our body, to the concoction they create, to the complexities they give birth to, and so on. You know, there's not many ways to free the mind. All great tradition will tell you, first, bring the mind to a place of a certain degree of peace, tranquility, and quietness. Now, check what you do during your daily life. How much causes for tranquility, peace, and quietness do you set up in your life to support this in your mind? And you could see that the whole path of practice is around creating the foundation to start really realizing the end of suffering, the end of attachment, the end of delusion, the end of greed, the end of anger, and so on. You know, whether it is the sila aspect of the practice, the ethical aspect, whose only reason, the Buddha says, is to be free from regret, because regret agitates the mind, and remorse. That's why the precepts, the ethical precepts, are so important, because they begin at a foundation, the foundational level. They begin to help the mind to lessen that tendency to be constantly in a state of turmoil about the unskillful things we have done by body, speech, and mind. You know, by body and speech, particularly by action, physical action and verbal action. So the foundation of sila is to bring a certain degree of peace to the mind, so that we can actually look into it and see what is really happening. And then the path of the aspect of wisdom, of right view, of right understanding, right intention. If you look at the, I'm not going to develop all this, but you would understand easily that the right intention is, you know, is defined as three things, which you don't need a huge expose to understand this. The Buddha says this right intention, which is a wisdom aspect of the path, or one of the points of the path, is actually, it's a very lovely thing, because those three aspects of right intention are somewhere else in the teaching of the Buddha described as the three kind of thoughts that arise in the mind of a Buddha. Still, the Buddha still has thoughts, you can see. It's not blanked out. And these three thoughts are the thought of non-ill will, non-harming, and renunciation. And renunciation, people are trembling in their boots when you talk about renunciation, because, oh my God, what's that, But really, the core of renunciation is just the letting go, the releasing, the freeing of greed, hatred, and delusion. That's the real renunciation. All the aspect of renouncing, unskillful speech, is letting go. All this practice of letting go you are cultivating in your life is renunciation. So, and again, this is to simplify, to relax the mind, to let go of this tension of grasping and clinging and holding, you can see my hand, it's not particularly, and then relax them. Oh, so nice. You know, I can do lots of things with my hand when I relax them. And I like this, and not much, because I'm punching people in the face. Not particularly relaxing, you know. Oh, it's not like a nice calming effect, is it? Well, this is what we do to our mind a lot, don't we? That's why people were very tense and very kind of, you know, grasping on things and, you know, kind of invested in things. You can feel it, can't you? Their mind is just like this, like a fist shape, you know. Never thought of it like that, but quite a good image, you know. You kind of fist at the level of your head. You kind of bumping into everything. Wanting to punch everybody. So that's also, bringing a foundation of peace at some level, isn't it? Loving kindness, harmlessness, non-ill will, you know. And then, you know, then you get the meditation aspect, the mind development aspect, which is our meditation, which is about bringing peace and letting the mind relax and, you know, calming down the mind. And then after that, looking into the nature of the mind, looking into the nature, looking into the content of your mind, and getting gaining confidence that this mind, you know, you can actually come to a place where the handle you can have on it is not through wanting to get rid of it, but through seeing it so clearly that how would you want to get attached to something that is such a factory of misery? I mean, one would be stupid, wouldn't we? It's kind of churning stuff, you know, all the time. Making you separate from everything else. Making you identified with stuff you can't stand. I mean, all of us would love to be a peaceful, kind, loving being. And then we get sort of, you get this tension around our negative self. And then your conditioning, as I said earlier, you know, it's like, oh, I hate that. Got to meditate. To get rid of it quick. And if you don't get rid of it, then you get frustrated. Then blame the teacher for it. Blame Rodney. For not giving you a clearer insight into the nature of your stupidity. See? We blame people, you know, we blame the projection of our mind constantly. That's why we are entangled into a really difficult predicament. So remember the source of your life, of your world, where the world begins and ends, and see the practice, you know, in a very from a very practical point of view. Don't try to become something or get rid of things. Just use your life as, you know, a process of understanding yourself, a process of knowing yourself, a process of coming to be at peace with yourself, you know, being at peace with this very unsatisfactory factory of misery. And then, as you are more at peace, then you discover the peace that lies all around it, which is a peace of non-attachment, non-greed, non-hatred, non-stupidity, a peace of awakening, you know, the peace of realization of the mind and the quality of the mind when it's not attached, where you can tap into wisdom, into compassion, into, you know, you can do this, you can live so much more happily without all that stuff. And yet, you know, you need to really keep looking at the, as I said, the stuff, you know, with a capital S, to understand that this is just things moving in and out, and it's a make-believe kind of, you know, world. And so we need to really realize what we are doing when we practice and how we hold this practice and what kind of understanding we have of it. Whether we are lay or monastic, whether we are men or women, whether we are young or old, you know, we all are capable of knowing the mind, knowing the content of the mind, knowing actions, knowing our speech. There's no limit to the mind and how much we can understand it and let it go. There's no limit. God is our limit. I used to sit in full lotus, half lotus, and I can't anymore. I'm on a bench. But that's all right. You know, this is the limit of the body. We're all getting older. We're all not getting younger. And so the practice, you know, is also a way of, you know, making peace with life as it moves on, as we all come from young, middle age to aging to dying and so on. This is also an enormous, you know, your bank account might not going up, you know, might not getting being filled right now, but the practice itself is a most wonderful investment. So I leave you on this. And if you have any questions, please feel free to ask. Yes.
I've read so many translations of the Buddha's last words. The one I remember is, be a lamp unto yourself. I'm wondering how you translate it and what it means to you in light of your talk, which seemed to be about that.
Well, be a lamp unto yourself is that, you know, I mean, it's almost explicit, isn't it? You know, switch the light on and look. You know, don't just look at it. Just don't look at the lamp, you know, just switch it on. And what he's pointing to is, don't, you know, many people think, I wasn't in India 2,500 years ago, but I'd imagine, you know, the guru relationship with teacher and swamis and so on, you know, must have been very prevalent in those days. And, oh, just a belief in scriptures and traditions and so on. So he was really trying to make people understand that this is not the base of realization and liberation. The base of liberation was just to really look and see where the world of ignorance and delusion arises and where it ends. And we don't need to die for that, you know, we just can, now, in every moment, we can see the beginning and the ending of delusion. So, is that enough? Didn't you say also strive with diligence?
Yes.
Ah, I thought you forgot that one.
So, also just the sense of don't believe experience for yourself. Just gather it for yourself. Don't
believe?
Don't believe what I tell you. Experience.
Well, exactly, exactly.
Work for yourself.
That's it. That's it.
Look hard and long and diligently.
And that's right. And everybody has heard this? That's it. Do I need to add anything? No. You understand that, don't you? Do you need a great sort of teaching on this? I mean, you believe in yourself all the time, don't you? I mean, somebody challenged your opinions. Aren't you going to, you know? I'm not joking. It's a habit, isn't it, already? In the mind. If I challenge your views, oh my God. Yeah, I mean, he's saying basically, you know, see for yourself, because nobody is going to meditate on your body and your mind. Nobody's going to do that. Can't do that. I only me can know myself, can know my mind. Nobody else. I mean, maybe a Buddha can see what I'm, you know. But it's not just a question of seeing. It's also a question of transformation, you know. So that's a Buddhist path. It's just transformation comes, you know, liberation comes from yourself knowing how to stop attaching to those three aspects of the mind of delusion, anger, and greed. Many of us, you know, will, it's a kind of lazy mind. You know, the lazy mind will believe easily. You know, what I call the lazy mind is a mind that just doesn't have sometimes to have a non-lazy mind, you need a certain conditions. You know, it's a condition that are very unpalatable in our culture. As I say in the Zen tradition, you know, great doubt bring great faith, you know. And in the Buddhist tradition, I would say from experience, you know, and other teachers, you know, it's like being able to bear with things that are unbearable can also lead to transformation. You can let go of things. You know, the kind of momentum of energy that just comes from being with the suffering of, you know, of the body and mind. I mean, sometimes it doesn't have to be huge or anything like that, you know. But if we cannot bear with delusion, if we cannot bear with a manifestation of greed or hatred, or then it's very difficult to see the end of it. You know, we need to see the nature of those, the true nature of the illusory nature of these states of mind. You know, yeah. And so, you know, if you just take somebody's word, you know, for granted, then, you know, it may be a pointer, you know, like for teaching or pointing to things, and that's useful. And my teacher says something to me in a difficult time or when I need maybe his help, you know, and when he says, he doesn't need to say very much, maybe two or three words for me, you know, makes me get my whole mind into action. You know, it's like an action, I don't mean doing something, but it's like a pointer, it's like a direction, you know. And even we're always in the here and now, it's more a direction of remembering. Do you know what I mean? It's you're directed to remember. That's all. Yeah? Is that enough? Okay.
How you made a decision on your teacher.
To become a nun?
No.
No, sorry, I didn't hear what you said.
The teacher that you had.
Oh, sorry. Oh, I didn't take decision, he just came to me. I was living about 600 miles from him, and he just came to visit the place I was living, where I was living. And I did not want a teacher. I never thought of having a teacher, but I met Achin Sumedho when he was visiting the place where I was living at the time, in England, north of England. And so I didn't choose him because I didn't look for a teacher particularly, but I didn't even want to do retreats, you know, that kind of thing. I didn't want to meditate much. But I was searching, you know, I was searching for something. I was married at the time. And in the process of really wondering where my life, you know, sort of which turn my life was going to take, you know, in terms of for inwardly. So I was deeply searching, but not, but yeah, I was quite convinced that a teacher would not do it for me at some level. You know, I was too arrogant to think that anybody could help me anyway. Or conceited. I didn't believe in teachers much, you know. But I didn't believe, I mean, I was searching, you know, I was desperately searching, looking for a way out somehow. You don't know. I didn't think of those terms, you know. I was more thinking in terms of you know, making my mind, my heart peaceful, the silent heart, you know, the silent mind. I was into silence. At some point I realized that silence was gold, you know, something very special about silence. So I wasn't into teaching or teachers or anything like that, but I discovered the intelligence of silence, you could say, the wisdom, the compassion, the treasure of silence. So I was totally hooked on it, actually. Not God, but silence, you know. And, you know, I had a busy mind, and I was very talkative, extrovert, you know, energetic, and so on. So silence was quite contrary to my nature in some ways, but suddenly when I discovered it, it was like a drug. I got really interested. I never taken drugs much, you know, or anything. But I can imagine if one gets hooked on something that is likable, you know. Well, I mean, plenty of drugs around, foods, you know, other things, chocolate, other drugs. But I find silence was very important for me then. And it guided me in a way. Do you know what I mean? This silence, I could see there was a guiding sort of force in there. I wasn't looking for guidance particularly, but I knew that it's almost brought in me the kind of mind of faith, you know. I wasn't a faithful type at all, but that was like the realm of confidence somehow. I could feel that, you know. And I trusted it so much, you know. And that took me to, you know, one Tuesday, I still remember, one Tuesday being in a restaurant talking about all my dance projects for the year. And then by the Wednesday, I was back to a meditation class with Achen Sumedho, and Thursday, I was at Chittas Monastery. And by Thursday night, I was staying at Chittas for the rest of my life, more or less. even though when Achen Sumedho said to me, I was talking about the world and saying, you know, I love the world, I love life. Life is wonderful, full of challenges, you know, it's no problem. I find it so interesting and so on, you know. And he said to me, well, I suppose it's a matter of knowing what the world is, isn't it? And suddenly I had, even though I've read it millions of times, suddenly I realized I was the world. Just what I was talking to you tonight about, you know. I was the world. I was free. I mean, always a sense of liberation, you know. I can do what I want. I am this world, you know. Who am I to blame? Of course, I spent 20 years blaming others, don't worry. Delusion didn't kind of leave instantly, you know. You know, but there was at that moment, there was a sense, oh, I can stay in this. I had already done a retreat with Achen Sumedho for 10 days, and I loved it. Everything. Even eating 1 meal a day was great. You know, so I was completely hooked on it, you know. I really liked it. So, you know, I thought to myself, well, I had a bargaining mind, you know, said, well, 10 days, after 10 days I noticed that the transformation was so mega in me that I thought, well, 10 days, you got that much. 3 months, you'll be, you know, fixed for the rest of your life. 3 months, you know. And then, of course, after 3 months, I realized it was a lifetime work. You know, there was no ending to it. And, you know, monastic life is so supportive. For me, it was so supportive of something I knew was very necessary, like, for example, the ethical aspect. You know, it was the channeling of energy in one direction, which I was totally unable to do as a lay woman. Remember when you're French, you know, you have already a deep conditioning to work with, which is love, all the things that sensual, beautiful, and, you know, all the sense pleasures are not just seen in France. They're just an art of life, you know, an art of a way of living, sort of, which is kind of more an art form than anything like that. The French are quite conceited about their food and sex and all the rest of it, you know, because it's not seen as a big problem. It's just, you know, a way of life. And I had to recognize that putting the foot on the British soil was for me already intense renunciation. I remember this about 20 years after I started the monastic life, and suddenly my heart felt so loving toward myself. I said, oh, Sundra, you've done very well, really. You know, the Scottish nun, I mean, they're already dour when they come to the monastery. Oh, already into all the Protestant kind of seriousness and, you know, no sense, not too much sensory pleasure and all that sort of thing, you know. For me, I come from the south of France, you know, Provence, you know, I mean, the world of pleasure down there, you know. So, I leave you on these words, unless there is another question, but I think we have to leave. We have to finish. My pleasure.